living with Kansas. I was born here, close to the banks of the Wild Missouri, which to me as a child was a massive brown and muddy beast, a dark bear, mysterious in its desires, pawing its way step by step through deep woods, unstoppable, defiant even, a force so strong and sure of itself, it almost made me feel safe. In many ways it did. As a small child, my paternal grandfather, Grandpa as I knew him, would bring me to play in this park on a high bluff far above the Big Muddy. Once when I was maybe 4 or nearly 5, we marched across the old railroad bridge from Kansas to Missouri. How delighted we were, both with one another, as if we had crossed into another country. We who were like Lewis and Clark, grand explorers. I loved him dearly, as he loved me, taking me with him to all his local haunts, the VFW Hall, the American Legion, where he would always order a tall, cold beer, and I, in my turn, a root beer. We were partners of conspiracy then. I knew intuitively not to tell of our grand adventures. No one knew except the two of us in those days. We were fearless together. The world to me was so big and yet safe too. We walked as companions of fate that fate could not begin to touch. Our horizons, boundless in possibilities.
Welcome to Poets Cafe. This is host Lois B. Jones. Ron Starbuck is visiting us from Houston, Texas. Ron is first an Episcopalian, a poet, writer, and publisher of St. Julian Press. He's the author of 3 poetry collections, Wheels Turning Inward, When Angels Are Born, and his most recent release, There Is Something About Being an Episcopalian. Ron has been deeply engaged in an interfaith Buddhist-Christian dialogue for many years and holds a lifelong interest in Christian mysticism, comparative religion, theology, and various forms of contemplative practice. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you, Lois.
So happy to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, such a beautiful poem that you started with, your place of birth. And it makes me think of how, you know, the way you created this poem, there's such a sense of an openness of a child, a trust, a faith, and also a kind of sanctity in one space, as you mentioned in the poem, feeling very safe. Do you think there's a place in the world still like that, or are we sort of nostalgic for those days, you know, when we could feel that kind of all-encompassing safety?
I do think that there are places that are safe like that. You know, most of us find those places amongst our family and friends and our closest intimate relationships. And that's what grounds us, those types of relationships. And if you come from a closely knit family, I think you find it there.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. I've been contemplating that just, you know, because of these violent times we seem to be in. And I mean, each period has its challenges, but this one, of course, is really...
it's a tough time.
It's a tough time, but it's true. We can be grounded in our family and our friends. I know that your father was a Methodist minister. How did your father's faith impact your life growing up in the Midwest?
Interesting question. So many thoughts running through my mind.
Yeah.
One of the things it did is it gave me exposure at a very young age, age 8 or 9 or 10, mm-hmm. to theological thought that most children would not have been exposed to, because at that point in my life, I was 8 and 9 and 10 and 11. And he was in the midst of grad school. And he would come home and talk about some of his classes and what he was learning. But then he would take that and write a sermon about it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he always memorized his sermons.
Oh, wow.
And so he Amazing. Would walk around the house and you would hear them 8 or 10 times before Sunday.
I love that.
And then you would hear them on Sunday.
Yeah.
So I would get exposure to some of the mid-20th century theologians like Paul Tillich, mm-hmm. Karl Barth, a host of others. And I don't know, I think my subconscious picked up on it and stored it away and remembered much of that as I got older, and then went back and began to read their works.
And were you practicing the Methodist faith when you were a child?
Yes, I mean, it was born into that particular denomination. Mm-hmm. I was baptized as an infant. My great-great-grandfather was a Methodist circuit rider
Oh, wow.
in Kansas, and my great-uncle was a Methodist minister, my grandfather's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the way, my dad decided he needed to do that too. So he went back to school and went back to seminary and was active in that ministry for most of the 1960s and up through 1974. And then he left it and became a practicing psychotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
And went back to school, got his PhD in marriage and family counseling from Texas Women's University at the Texas Medical Center. And he did that for 40 years, almost all the way up until the time of his death.
Were you ever tempted to become a minister yourself?
At some point when I was maybe in high school thinking about it, early years of college, I think when he left it, it kind of released me from any feeling of obligations
okay.
there.
Yeah, and then you started to delve into all these other philosophies, and you started reading heavy writers at that time, John Paul Sartre, and in your teen years and so on.
Yeah, in my early college years, I was reading that. I was developing an inner interfaith dialogue inside myself at the age of 15. But you had to realize that was in probably the late 1960s, where a lot of that was taking place culturally.
Mm-hmm.
And you were getting more and more exposure to Buddhism and Hinduism and different types of techniques in meditation, like transcendental meditation.
Did you try that?
Tibet. I probably tried a little bit of everything along the way. Yeah, I wanted
right.
some exposure to it.
Okay.
And it was certainly in the music at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that. But then when I went off to college and I was taking classes in religion and philosophy, I was getting more exposure to it.
And how did you eventually turn to becoming an Episcopalian?
Oh, that's another long story.
Okay, you can make it shorter.
Yeah. Real quickly, my dad had a lot of friends that were Episcopal priests mm-hmm. and involved in the Episcopal Church. And one of the things he liked to do when we were kids growing up is after we would have Christmas Eve services with him at the Methodist Church early in the evening, we would go home and open presents. Santa always came early to our house.
Mm-hmm.
And after we kind of got through opening presents and sharing and things like that, it would get close to 11 or 11:30 at night. And he said, well, let's go up to the Episcopal Church for midnight mass. And we would do that. And we did that almost year after year. So that was really my exposure to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I eventually dated someone in my mid-30s who was Episcopalian.
That'll do it.
Yeah, and she also grew up Methodist, so
okay.
And that relationship didn't quite work out, but it gave me a taste for wanting to go back to more organized religions, and I did that eventually.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go for many, many years. I just wasn't interested, so.
Right. That's interesting, because I wasn't sure, you know, if your father accepted you going from the Methodist to the Episcopalian.
He did.
Yeah.
And when my wife and I were married in the Episcopal Church almost mm-hmm. 20 years ago, he was one of the officiating clergy at that particular wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So he helped tie the knot with us.
Is there a way to briefly summarize what that faith is, distinguishing it from other Christian beliefs? I ask you that because it's such a big part of your life, and we're going to get into that a little bit more.
If you were to look at Episcopalians and what you would probably classify them as are sacramental Christians as opposed to evangelical Christians. So sacramental Christians would fall into the category of Eastern Orthodox or Greek Orthodox or Roman Catholic or Anglican across the Anglican Communion and Episcopalians in the United States. So it sort of falls into that category. But it's very, very traditional, kind of high church kind of stuff and liturgy. So it's a liturgical tradition as well.
If you're just tuning in, this is Lois P. Jones on Poets Cafe with my wonderful guest, Ron Starbuck, who's visiting us from Houston, Texas, and we're talking about faith and religion and perhaps transformation. I'd love to move to your next poem, Voices, and then we can talk a little bit more about this expanding perception that you've had.
Voices, 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 like the poet Rilke, with each breath taken, I have heard and have heard the angels calling out from the depths. Let them speak as the whisperings of holy messengers in the unfathomable night time before dawn, upon the air in a quickening of flesh. These are the forgotten memories we may one day recall more often than we suspect, subtle and obscure, traveling on countless pathways of neural light, crossing our thoughts with distant remembrances that arise out of the silence of the saints. These are the voices I heard once before in a church north of Pienza when we traveled in Italy. We're lighting a candle and bowing her head. Joanne offered with a sad smile and a small hope prayers for a close friend who was ill at the time, struggling in life and in death as we all do. In every church and chapel we entered that journey, she repeated the ritual, and in each one I heard the same order of murmuring voices. Not that I could understand their musings, far from it, since they spoke only in hushed tones, in the ineffable and intangible tongues of angels and heaven. Verse after verse follows each breath we breathe. They flow in as a chorus, every word coming quickly, expressed ever so faintly, not always distinct, flowing sensuously over the body like soft fallen rain running over the earth and washing away, vanishing. And then they return in a shower of lyrics in a moment or even years later, each word rushing in with such a haste, anxiously waiting in expectation to take its place. Out of this silence, the poet within conceives unknown, unheard languages of the spirit, new words and verses flowing out unhindered as a blessing, encompassing the wonder of life from the waters of mnemosyne that pour forth. Let the memory speak. Each poet writes in their own angelic tongue, and humankind listens, or they do not. Do you? Sometimes the angels speak too fast, and they are rarely kind or generous in their time. We cannot write the words down quickly enough. Something is always left unwritten. Words and images, thought after thought, come and go on. It all overflows, and you can never know what the angels may honestly want you to write, since they do not speak plainly. You must seek the beloved only she can translate such language as a muse, and something more dwelling within us. It is truly unexpected how even the stars fall silent in her presence. One day soon, we will all become fluent in her angelic tongue.
Beautiful. There's so many aspects here that can draw from different influences, different beliefs. And I was surprised, I don't know if you know this, you know, we're both Rilke lovers. Rilke's angels were actually, he was reading the Quran when he was finishing off the Duino elegies, and he said something to his translator in a 1925 letter, don't make the mistake of thinking that this angel is a Christian angel. And I was really surprised to read that, because, you know, like you, Rilke drew from different beliefs. I mean, he started out as a Christian, and he studied Buddhism, he studied other religions as well. So even in your poem, that angel to me takes on other dynamics, aside from what we know, you know, the typical thought we have of the Christian angel. Like when you refer, for example, to holy messengers, you ask them to speak, and then you say, these are the forgotten memories we may all one day recall more often than we suspect, subtle and obscure, etc. Are you referring to like other lives, or what are these memories, or do you want to say?
Well, in some ways, that's an allusion to how Buddhism looks at human consciousness, in that. So I'm kind of pulling from that particular tradition and sort of putting it into the poem. And if you were aware of those teachings in Buddhism, you might pick up on it or you might not pick up on it. But one of the things they talk about when you go through a rebirth, so they talk about it in terms of rebirth, that you retain a subtle memory of, your consciousness retains a subtle memory of a previous life or something. But that consciousness, there's a continuity to the consciousness, and it exists outside of this life or that life or another life. There's a continuity of that consciousness, and as you move through those, there's a subtle memory that's at play and takes place. And I sometimes wonder if maybe that's where we get our feeling of deja vu.
Yes, exactly. I think it's really fascinating that Buddha and Christ can coexist in this, in the trinity of the Episcopalian world. I mean, how you've merged those together, and I find that really intriguing.
Well, it's just expanding an interfaith dialogue between the two. But your mention of the Quran is appropriate as well. If you look at the work of Rumi, he traveled all over what we know of as the Middle East and ancient Persia and Turkey, and he probably stepped his foot into church and shrine and mosque, so I suspect that he entered synagogues at the time, he entered a mosque, certainly, and ancient Christian churches that were around.
Right, exactly. So, a comment I wanted to make is from Aliki Barnstone. She's a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Missouri. I have to say it like you say it.
Missouri.
She says, Ron Starbuck is a poet who has taken to heart and soul the teaching in Psalm 46, be still and know that I am God. And I thought how beautiful that was in the context of your dialogue that you're having, because the stillness takes on another element when you talk about Buddhism and other types of beliefs.
Yes, I mean, in any type of meditation, whether it's Buddhist meditation or Christian type meditation or some combination of the two, you're basically sitting there together in silence. And there are people who would look at that act, whether you're Buddhist or Episcopalian or Christian or even Muslim, they would see that sitting in silence together in meditation and even prayer as a type of sacrament, mm-hmm. where you are encountering and can and may encounter the ultimate divine mystery of creation, however you might want to describe that in your own vocabulary.
Beautifully said. Let's get on to one more of your poems before we talk a little bit about your St. Julian Press. This is Lois P. Jones. I'm host of Poets Cafe. We're here with our guest, Ron Starbuck, and speaking of consciousness, religion, we've been talking a lot about that in these last couple of days. How about reading The Monarch?
The Monarch. Landing lightly, she came as a revelation, a benediction, enfolded in the rich ginger and auburn of her monarch wings, a mystery whose color I cannot clearly disclose or discern, reminding me of a near friend whose most intimate looks and gestures are a language unto her own, one we share in wonder-filled moments together, uncovering veiled places which can never be denied, as time releases a newness that cannot easily be named or found in all the known colors of this earth. In the monarch's flight, she binds us together softly, upon wings that barely touch, so delicate in appearance and beauty, they simply break open our own hearts, revealing their truest majesty. We have learned to be brave together, fearless in spirit, in a garden held independent of time. She takes my breath, folding it into her own with the brightness of her being, and of us together, giving us breath as we dwell in one another, as one body in one motion, in the delicate flow of the monarch's wings, in her softness, her gentleness as she opens to me. Is not each star a witness to this unity? I love the color and shape of her eyes, and how they capture mine, and how I see a reflection of her always in me, waiting like spring, when the milkweed blossom opens itself as a mystery to the first monarch.
Love that poem. Gosh, that's one of my favorites of yours. And the subtitle, Anamkara, means, it's a Celtic word, right? It means soul friend.
It does.
And it has a relationship with the book by John O'Donohue, the Book of Celtic Wisdom.
And John O'Donohue was a Catholic priest at one point,
mm-hmm.
and also a poet. He was also good friends with David White, the poet that people may be familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
It's from what we've learned, it's an ancient Celtic tradition, Anamkara, soul friend, someone you open yourself up to in trust and in friendship, and you can have these deep soul-searching conversations with and sharing your dreams with. Yeah. I certainly do that with my wife, Joanne.
Mm-hmm.
But I do it with...
Who's listening now.
Yeah. I do it with other friends like you.
Mm-hmm. Thank
we
you.
Have those kind of conversations.
Do you think that's something that one can build? Or like, can we all potentially be Anamkaras for one another? Or do you think it's just something we intuit and feel and are able to express with only certain people?
I think it's a rare occurrence,
okay,
that you can only really maybe do it with certain people. But then the other thought I have is we have grown up in a society that doesn't and hasn't taught us to value these types of intimate relationships.
So true.
And we tend to confuse sensuous things with intimacy,
mm-hmm.
where there's a whole nother level of intimacy that occurs, I think, at a spiritual level. And that's a good description of an Anamkara.
Yes, it is. It's great. We're running out of time now, and I want to just hit on really quickly talking about your press. St. Julian was the namesake of your press was a woman, Julian of Norwich, which I didn't realize. And she was a 14th century English mystic and anchoress. So you have a number of wonderful poets, Melissa Stoddard, Fred Lamont, David Glenn Smith, Kevin McGrath, I mean, to name a few. What is the thread that unites these authors?
A poetic and literary dialogue
mm-hmm.
that unites them. But in some form, they all touch upon the sacred and place a value on the sacred, and they place a value on relationships and that interrelatedness that we have with one another, that connecting spirit that we have with one another. So I see that as a thread that runs through all their poetry.
Right, and it's really sort of an expansion of your own personal sense and philosophy. So we're out of time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been so great to have you. We've enjoyed having our guest. This is host Lois P. Jones, and our guest tonight has been Ron Starbuck, publisher of St. Julian's Press. Many thanks to our producer, Marlena Bond. Look for us on the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.